I may be exaggerating. Let's say 20% of our school was Armenian. I would say only 10% was Mexican at that point. But the other grammar schools, feeder schools to Stevenson, were in vast majority Mexican American kids. And it was there that I first came into the tension, the racial tension, ethnic tension with Mexican Americans and Anglos, and saw the way the teachers treated them.
How was that?
They were treated with tolerance. It was part of the job of some of these teachers. They weren't all that way. Not all these teachers were that way. You could see that some of the leading teachers tolerated these kids who were had language problems in the sense they were speaking Spanish in the home and English in the school. My enlightenment on the whole question came, and there was a Mr. Heil, H-E-I-L. And he was a man in his 30s, and he was thin enough to be frail even, but he was a bully to us, junior high school kids who were all 4 foot something, you know. And a Mexican kid came in, was transferred in, and we had Mr. Heil. Was it Heil? I'm not sure of the name any longer, because there was another science teacher named with a similar name. And this man was tall and slender, and this Mexican kid came in who had a bigger language problem than most of the other Mexican kids. A husky kid, thick set. And teacher began to intimidate him and single him out and make fun of him. And the kid cut through all of that. Stood up one day in the midst of one of these tirades and said, "I have a brother. He's as big as you. And he will fight you after school." And the teacher backed down in front of us all, lost his composure, the whole thing. And that was an eye-opener for us all. When the kid got up to talk, I thought, God, is that stupid? And I saw it work. And the guys who terrorized us, the gangs with knives in Stevenson Junior High, surround a white guy, an Anglo, draw their knives, and then talk about how sharp the knives were. And so one of the gangs is led by a Russian named Alex Volkov. He had three languages, Russian, Spanish, and English. And a guy named Tony Blanco, called himself Tony Blanco de la Luz. Loud and bully and intimidating. Big for junior high. And he and I went at it time and time again. And Rooster's gang operated. That's a very famous gang in East LA. This guy is still remembered. Both of those guys were promoted and decorated in the field, and both the World War II and Korean War. Tony Blanco was finally retired from the Army as a colonel, a full colonel. Never went to West Point or anything like that. I mean, in the field. And Rooster got something just this side of Congressional Medal, and he was still having a bullet went through his face, and he was still having cosmetic surgery when I saw him the last time. We were big buddies at that point.
Well, so in this in the mid 30s, then the kids were running gangs in your neighborhood.
So. Oh yeah, heavy gangs. But that all disappeared in high school. Same kids. But the way I've come to see it is that those Mexican American kids, particularly the boys. 99% the boys, found themselves in a strange country with this language problem, and they sensed in this depression that absolutely nothing was ahead of them in this life, so far as finding a place in the universe for themselves where they could live and feel secure. And their resentment, as kids entering puberty, those junior high school years, their sense of insecurity was so great that their anger had to come out somewhere, and they took it out among the people who were closest to them.
So, and their activity generally, if they ran a gang, their activity was had some violence attached to it.
Intimidation, mainly. Mm-hmm. And once in a while, it'd be a real honest-to-God exchange.
Was the gangs definitely ethnically divided up?
Totally.
Totally. Did Armenian kids have a gang?
No. It was just on an Anglo-Mexican-American basis.
The Russian that you were telling me.
He lived in the heart of a Mexican neighborhood.
Oh, so he ran with a Mexican.
Yeah. I saw him years later.
At that age, tell me, were you involved in sports?
Yeah.
Did you have any?
At junior high, no, you just played at gym period and noontime. There are no teams yet. I had been the guy in the sixth grade, the big guys who were already 10 inches taller than the rest of us, some of them, in the sixth grade. Because my mother worked for this rich woman, we had access to her box at the Hollywood Bowl and the Philharmonic. And I went more often to the Philharmonic and the Hollywood Bowl than the woman who bought the tickets. My mother and I would go. And the opera. I saw Max Reinhardt's production of Midsummer Night's Dream with Mickey Rooney as Puck. I will never get over it. The magic of that. Well, now, as a child exposed to that kind of theater and culture, it immediately set me apart from all my peers. The teachers immediately recognized that this kid here, this red-headed one, had some middle-class sophistication, knew what certain art forms were, and the response, and at the same time, I wasn't a horn-rimmed glasses, stereotypical bookworm. As a matter of fact, there was no one at home at my house until 7 in the evening, sometimes later, and I was on the street playing ball. And the big guys took me in and said, "Hey, you're going to be one of us." And I said, "You guys are better ball players than I am." They said, "We're going to change that. You're the second baseman on the team." And they worked with me until I became a competent second baseman. And I'll never forget it. But that set a pattern for the entire life. That is, with one foot with the regulars, tough guys, and one foot somewhere in this middle class, pseudo-intellectual, semi-intellectual, cultural media, and with some kind of insight into what in the world was going on in Hollywood. And I understood that industry. My Uncle Stan wound up in local 44 IATSC, set dressers and grips. And that carried over. And I wound up on the basketball team. I was never a great athlete, just good enough to make the team. I was kind of tall, finally. I grew almost a foot in a year.
What year was that?
I left the ninth grade in Stevenson Junior High, and I think I was 5'1 or 4'11". And by the time I left the 10th grade, I was 6'2", and I weighed 137 pounds.
What high school did you go to?
Garfield. which is near Atlantic and Wheaton.
Who are your heroes?
Lindbergh, Lindbergh, Charles A. Lindbergh. Freudian twists are always correct. Charles A. Lindbergh was a big one. 1927. Mm-hmm. I was 6 years old. Mm-hmm. All the kids in the block thought every plane that went overhead had Lindy in it. Most of the planes are monoplanes. Mm-hmm. And were going overhead. Some biplanes too, you know. Cotton-top Warburton, an All-American quarterback from USC, was a big hero of mine. A basketball player from Indiana at USC named Ralph Zahn, all-coast high scorer. Guys like that. Roosevelt, certainly. Certainly. Franklin D. Roosevelt. As a matter of fact, I was editor of the senior annual, the yearbook. And I wrote to Roosevelt to dedicate, to write a dedication for the yearbook. And Stephen Early, his secretary, wrote me back and sent me a picture, an unpublished picture. And so I wrote the editorial, which said, right behind Roosevelt, that FDR has promised that no American mother-son will ever fight in a foreign battlefield, and we're closer to peace now than any other time in the previous decade. Of course, we were at war. We graduated in February of 1940. We were at war within less than 2 years. We had already entered the war, and the war was already a shooting war before that. And my prediction was pretty far off.
Yeah,
I was a believer in him. I wanted to believe that. And that later affected... I couldn't have ever joined any organization that was pro-war. Mm-hmm. And I joined the only socialist organization in the country that was anti-war, of any size, mm-hmm. that was opposed to the war from either Washington or Moscow mm-hmm. point of view. And was certainly anti-Hitler, of course, too.
What in your growing up gave you the anti-war, gave you this anti-war philosophy?
Well, it began with the fact that my teachers, and not just one or two, but pretty generally, with maybe one or two exceptions, every teacher I had at Eastman Street School was anti-war. Remember, this is 1925, 1926, 1927, 1928. World War I is only, you know, it was less than a decade behind us. All of these women had had some negative experience in relation to World War I. They were our teachers.
Were all of your grammar school teachers women?
With one exception. A gardening teacher named Nelson, who was magnificent, one of the best teachers I ever had.
Was he anti-war?
Yes. He was anti-war, but Miss Rivers, a peroxide blonde who played the ukulele and we sang an hour a day, told stories daily almost about the fact that World War I was a phony war. And she gave the details of her experience in relationship. And that stuck with me. At Beta Theta Pi on Monday nights at UCLA, they had the alumni come to eat with us. I was a pledge to that fraternity, briefly. And they got an Episcopal priest there and a businessman. And they said that we all ought to go and join up. And they got the head of the philosophy department, Miller, Mr. Professor Miller, to make the main speech to lead us to go and join. This is just a week after Pearl Harbor. And they went on and on like this, and I said, but everybody knows that World War, that last World War was fought for profit. I was really sort of quoting Miss Rivers.
Yeah.
They didn't know it.
Yeah.
And the businessman said, well, now there's a book. You get in the library, and if you read that book, you'll see it wasn't fought for profit. and the Episcopalian priest with his backward collar, big overweight man smoking a cigarette, he looked like a cartoon of the capitalist from the Daily Worker, said, "I'd like to say at this time that I would rather die a free man on a battlefield than live a slave under a despot." And I grew up. I said, "And no one is going to draft you. And no segment of the service would take you if you went and volunteered." And that was the end of me and fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
That night, almost.
Do you think your that your teachers in grammar school? Do you think some of them were politically?
I have no idea. I wouldn't have known. But there was more than that to the thing. Next door to us was a guy who was gassed in World War One, and he was a total alcoholic, and he drank himself into blindness. Now this is prohibition. Booze he's drinking. And his wife is dying too. She's joined him in this alcoholism as his companion. I can remember Sawtell, West LA, the veterans out there, and seeing every morning these guys string out these gas guys, and a few mustard gas guys with their faces half gone.
Was there a hospital out in the city?
That's just west of L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Sawtell
mm-hmm.
Hospital. It's now crossing the Veterans Administration building.
Mm-hmm.
A big veterans hospital with all the crosses and grass out there, hundreds of them. And that became, I always looked at that with a horror. It was something I really was alienated from, totally, war.
Did you have any religious experiences or affiliations when you were...
Yeah, we were in a... I grew up in a neighborhood in Boyle Heights where the Grace Methodist Church was it for us. And we had J. Bromley Oxnam, the number one guy, finally, in the Protestant big council as our minister. And when I was five, he was telling horror stories and yelling at the congregation a lot. And he'd get red in the face and apoplectic almost, it seemed to me. And I didn't like all this yelling at me. Told the story of a little boy who got a snake and took it to bed with him. And it bit him and he said, "Ouch." And his mother said, "What's the matter, Johnny?" And he said, "Nothing." And then he died. And I told my mother I want to go to a quiet church. I don't want anybody yelling at me anymore. And in those days, children could travel in a streetcar. Our family didn't have any cars, so all the conductors and motormen knew our family. So with a nickel, I could go downtown and back to Hope Street, where there were 17 churches, I think, in a row on Hope, from 7th down to Olympic and back. Big churches. And I went to two or three, and the fourth time, I guess it was, I went into the Christian Science Church, the quietest church in the whole world. No one talks. They're reading from the Bible. One person reads from the Bible, and the other person reads from Science and Health, A Key to the Scriptures by Mary Baker Eddy. And I said, I found a quiet church, and so that's where we went. And my mother took it very seriously. She joined too. But when I was about 14, I began asking questions, and magnificent school teacher, a Sunday school teacher, couldn't answer him. He wept. And not long thereafter, the lawyer who lived to the rear of us had collected works of many great authors, but among them, Mark Twain. And I read Mark Twain's book, Christian Science. And that was the end.
Yeah. Was Christian Science, was that anti-war?
No, not, well, it's generally pro-humanity, like all religions tell you. But I'm sure that they wound up supporting World War II. But I don't recall them ever addressing the question of war in any way.
So you made it through Garfield High School and graduated. What year did you graduate?
February 1940, mid-year.
And then where did you go to, what did you see when you graduated from high school, what did you see as your future?
I didn't know. I mean, I filed application. I went to 23 different factories, and three only would take applications even. And I was certain that they'd deep six those the minute I was out the door.
What kind of grades did you get? When you graduated, what kind of grades did you have? Were you encouraged to go on to college?
Well, in the seventh grade, they took in my class all the kids who were sort of college material and put them in a special, what was called experimental course. They just put us in there. No one was given a choice. And they quit, they dropped trying to teach us serious mathematics and English and so on, how to parse a sentence, and gave us courses on how to set a table and how to, which fork to use at a table and how to, manners, courses in manners and things like that. And this, then in the 10th grade in Garfield, they changed the name of the experimental course to revised curriculum. So that when I graduated, they told me that I had all these course deficiencies and I'd have to go 2.5 years to Los Angeles Junior College in order to go to college.
What was the point of this revised? Did you ever figure out what the point was?
Well, the rest of the story goes like this, and you can draw your own conclusions. I went one semester to Los Angeles Junior College, which later became City College. I had very good faculty people there, but I wanted to get into a college where I was taking college courses instead of these kind of intermediate. You had to get an A for it to count in college, and I got, I think, two A's and the rest B's and C's. So I went to UCLA, to the registrar, and I showed up with all my grade records and everything. And I told the woman that I said, I'll enter here as an extension. I know it's a lot more money, but I got a job for summer, and I want to go here. And she looked at that, and she said, you're in revised curriculum. I said, that's right. She walked to a cabinet, a series of filing cabinets, 20 feet back. She opened the drawer, and she pulled me out of the drawer. She said, you're in revised curriculum. And when we put on that course for the LA school system, we agreed to take all of you, regardless. All you had to do was have a C average and then pass all the courses that we were sticking in that program. And you can come here as a regular student and know. And I realized that they had told none of us about what was agreed to. Well, and I knew a number of guys who were working at Goodrich Rubber Company in East LA who wanted to go to college but were told they had to go two and a half years to do makeup and coursework. And I got in my car and I drove across to East LA, straight to Garfield High School, and I went and got Mr. Adamson, the voice vice principal, who really ran the school. The Herbert Woods, or the principal, really was a non-entity. And I backed him up against the wall. I was really not totally in control. I was going to hurt him. And he said, Stanley, do you think that we did this on our own initiative? Your fight is with the Los Angeles Board of Education. We do everything under instruction here. Now, whether he was just getting himself out or whether he was telling the truth, I never knew.
Well, that you were part of some experiment that UCLA was in on,
yeah.
The LA Board of Education was in on, and the school was in on, but
they never told us about it. As a matter of fact, when we were preparing for graduation ceremony and spending a lot of time, the whole class, in the auditorium practicing for the ceremony, they sent counselors, appeared before us from UCLA and USC, and both of them had the same speech: don't go to college, get a trade. When I did get to UCLA, I found that the kids who went to the West Side High Schools, like Uni High, were far more sophisticated in formal education and were way ahead of us in every way.
Was Garfield, would you classify Garfield High School as a working class high school? Or
totally.
And Uni High would probably, would that have been a more middle class high school?
And upper middle class. But,
have you ever figured out what was really going on?
It was class, that was what it was. It was a conscious effort on the part of the Board of Education. My homeroom teacher, who was no radical, I went to discuss it. I discussed it with her. I didn't open the discussion. I forget how it happened. But she said, look, Stanley, Garfield High is Siberia for teachers. And it began to dawn on me that there was a class society operating here. I didn't say use the term class, I don't think. But I knew that by income, students from families of higher income were getting much different treatment than the hourly employed on my side of town. The exception was that at Roosevelt, which was an East Side high school too, the exception was created for those kids, and I wish I had gone to that high school in many ways. The Jewish community was in the Roosevelt High territory. And they were working class Jews, but the very fact that they were urban people for a long time and were sophisticated politically and radical, the heart of radicalism in the city was Boyle Heights. And they were able to extract from the Board of Education, from the teachers and so on, much. As a matter of fact, Roosevelt High was sending, I am told, as many kids to college from each graduating class as the best high schools on the West Side. And we were sending 3 and 4 and 5 from Garfield. If I hadn't been for the GI Bill, a lot of the guys that I grew up with never would have gotten a shot at it because they missed it, because they'd lost out. I told as many as I could, made it a point, a crusade, to tell them about revised curriculum. But I didn't get to all of them.
Did you start UCLA?
The next semester. Well, let's see. In September 1940, I entered UCLA.
And what was your major at UCLA? Did you declare a major?
Liberal arts.
And you had no idea what you were
doing? I was a lower division student. I had no idea. I knew there would be something to do with literature.
Well, at this period of your life, what kind of things were you reading?
Thomas Wolfe had a big effect on me. The first book I read by him was The Web and the Rock. It has probably one of the most graphic and well-done descriptions of a lynching, I think, that exists in American letters. My mother tells me years later that while I was reading Thomas Wolfe in high school, that I went into like a spell. I didn't communicate with people.
What else were you reading besides Thomas Wolfe? Anything else?
Oh, Jack London.
Were you starting to come up with, in high school,
when you started to come up with some radical perspectives on what was going on in your life?
I believed until about the 8th grade. I was a believer. Maybe even the 9th grade. I was a believer in the system in the school. I was raising ideas and trying to make changes my own way. But in about the 8th or 9th grade, I was a member of the guard force, you know, traffic control in the hall and all of that. And a Slav, a Yugoslav,